Jazz Jamaica All-Stars with Ball of Fire. And it couldn't be more appropriate for today's discussion. Jazz Jamaica was the brainchild of bass player Gary Crosby. He is the nephew of famed Jamaican guitarist Ernest Ranglin, and he came up with this idea of bringing together expatriate Caribbean folks in London in 1991 and formed the group. And they've been touring worldwide since then with their unique sound, integrating reggae and jazz and ska and everything else that has noted fantastic pronounced rhythms, and of course featuring their bold horns. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Tuesday, February the 18th, and normally we would have our open forum today, but we're going to put that off until Friday because we wanted to do these two programs together, and logistically, this was the best way to do it. So open forum is on Friday. We will follow today the discussion of yesterday about this case, in the Stand Your Ground case in Florida that concluded on Saturday with no conviction on the main charge of first-degree homicide against Michael Dunn, who killed 17-year-old Jordan Davis in November of 2012 after a heated argument over loud music. The jury did, however, convict on three counts of attempted second-degree murder for shooting into the vehicle and consequently at other passengers, three other passengers in the SUV. Today we agreed to follow up because this is a Stand Your Ground case, so in a way we have to take a look at what that means. Although there are people who are saying, well, this really wasn't a Stand Your Ground case, but a self-defense case. We heard the same argument in the Zimmerman case, and you will recall that I said, even when the defense attorneys were saying this is not a Stand Your Ground case, I told you that we're going to bring in the Stand Your Ground argument through the back door, which they eventually did. Similarly, here in this case, they were saying that this was not a Stand Your Ground case, but that Michael Dunn was basically acting in self-defense because he felt threatened after the reaction of the passengers in the SUV, the parked SUV in which Jordan Davis was, along with three others, outside of a convenience store, that he felt threatened at the reaction, and he was certain that he saw Davis reach down for something that looked like a shotgun, which was pointed at him, and in that instant, he himself retrieved a weapon and fired 10 rounds into the car, into the SUV. Today, we have our guest again. Our guest is one of the most extraordinary lawyers I've ever seen, ever, and I'm not saying that lightly, in a court of law, and this is a separate issue, we will pick that up, but he has been prohibited, as it were, by the state legislature, not by any lawyer's panel, not by any committee who has found him to be afoul of the law, not by any complaint from any client that said he did anything wrong to them, but the state legislature. He is the only attorney in the history of the United States to be prevented from practicing law by a state legislature. And it was at the directive of then State Attorney General Robert Abrams, who assigned himself as special prosecutor in the Tawana Brawley case. And the rationale he gave to the state legislature was that Alton Maddox should not be allowed to practice law because he embarrassed this is the charge. He embarrassed the state of New York. And, of course, he embarrassed the state of New York by vigorously defending his client, by refusing the directive of Mr. Abrams to turn over all of his records despite attorney-client privilege, all of his records he wanted from Ultimatics, of course, who has resisted to this day, and we're going up to 3 decades of that. That is itself a blot on the state of New York. We will follow that case because I think we need to stand up for people who have stood up for a long time. And it is in my view, it is reprehensible that this unique action should befall an attorney who has had an extraordinary history of fighting for people's rights pro bono, without pay, and who has come to this unjust action, and it has remained in effect for all these years. The legal community has done nothing. The elected officials have done nothing. The governor of the state of New York, several governors of the state of New York have done nothing. So it is something that needs to be raised as an issue and that must be pressed. But today, this very attorney is going to course us through the origin of the Stand Your Ground statute. It is called Stand Your Ground, if you will, in the state of Florida. Colloquially, it is called that. But it exists formally in the state of Florida since 2005. But similar statutes exist across the United States. And as Alton pointed out yesterday, the statutes may be on the books in 25 states, including Florida, but it is implied in other statutes that are not specifically called Stand Your Ground. Well, welcome, Alton, after that very long and exhaustive introduction. I'm glad that you're still there, right?
I am here.
All right. Tell you what we're going to do today, folks. Alton is going to, so we do not interrupt him, he's going to present this piece for us, and then we'll open up to questions and comments right after that. So Alton will be speaking for about 30, 35 minutes. Thanks, Alton. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Eutrice. And I want to say a couple things that you raised in the introduction that I think at some point might be relevant to us as a people as we look at these cases, because I hope that after hearing what is being said today, that most of us as voters at least will be taking some legislative action to try to correct in our own states what has beset people in other states. And I hope that there will be an effort to make some remedial action to establish some kind of agenda to actually address these issues. Because on the white side, for example, especially the Tea Party types and all of those, they're very active in the legislative arena. And, you know, right from the first business day in a new year, they are ready, set, go. And what they do is look at all of the various loopholes that they think needs to be plugged up to give them an advantage in the legal process. Now, on the other side, most of us are not doing anything, and we don't have any agenda at all. We're taking no action. We have proposed no new laws or nothing. And then at the end of the day, when we get a miscarriage of justice, like in Florida versus Dunn, then we get very emotional and very upset. And I hope that we will change that, and I hope that people will hear something today that will motivate them to have certain changes in their own lives. Now, the other thing I would like to point out, you know, it's sort of interesting, so that the listening audience may really be aware of this, is that you're absolutely correct in my particular situation that this would be the first time ever that a lawyer has been barred from a courtroom based on legislative complaints. However, I think it would be fair if our audience knew just a little bit more about the history of all of this and how other people react to particular situations. And I could mention the Howard Beach case is one instance in which 62 district attorneys in this state of New York felt threatened by losing some of their own turf if the exercise of the appointment of special prosecutors would become normal. And so nobody, you know, you're talking about natural law, and one of the aspects of natural law is that nobody likes to give up the end of their turf. So there are always the turf wars that are taking place, but nobody wants to give up their particular turf. And so when prosecutors began to see, as they saw in Queens County and then as they saw again in Dutchess County, machinery occurring in which blacks would begin to question the fairness of a elected prosecutor to actually participate in the legal process, and particularly in a racially motivated case. There were obviously a lot of discussion, and then there were some changes. So that is one particular example in terms of Howard Beach, where for the first time a special prosecutor was appointed in the nation in a racially motivated case. And obviously in that particular case, there were convictions because there was no conviction of murder in the first degree. And one of the things I think we should point out now is that in our research, we will never find any white person who had ever been convicted of murder in first degree with respect to a black person. So, you know, over time, when you conduct the research, you may find some conviction for civil rights violations where the Justice Department may, in a few instances, intervene and got conviction. But these were not first-degree murder convictions. These were civil rights violations. So the whole notion of trying to get one of these first-degree murder violations is still a work in progress. And I think what our goal here is, how do you level the playing field in such a way that may be possible, especially when the flip side is that you're going to have other people who will be engaged in the legislative process and the judicial process to maintain the status quo. And so I go back then to the second reason why the New York legislature were particularly motivated to take action against me, in addition to Howard Beach. And the second case was that of Marlon Hanson, in which a white model accused three men, two of whom were black, of actually carving up her face with a razor blade. And so obviously there was a lot of emotion in the city as a result of that, and people were very much concerned about that particular case. And in that particular case, it certainly wasn't easy for me to be involved in it because there was all kind of legal shenanigans going on as we were actually engaged in the defense of our client. And there were a lot of negative racial comments taking place. I can recall in one instance, Irene Cornell, who is a journalist for WCBS Radio, jumped up in the middle of the courtroom and said to the judge, "Can somebody stop that black gorilla from cross-examining that white woman like that?" And obviously, when we had a recess, my response to her was, no, nobody can stop this black gorilla because I'm the ringmaster of this circus. And so, you know, it's left up to me as how these matters to be conducted. Now, that then generated more controversy, which then led the mayor of the city of New York, Ed Koch, to demand that Justice Jeffrey Alice on television actually apologize for allowing me to conduct the kind of examination that was actually required by the Sixth Amendment. I wasn't doing anything in violation of the law. I was actually applying the law. And so Judge Atlas eventually had to apologize because he had to save his job. Of course, nobody never asked me to apologize because they knew what the answer would have been had anybody ever posed a question to me. But it didn't stop there. Eventually, the New York legislature, looking at this particular issue, then passed a law curbing the right of a lawyer to cross-examine a victim in a rape case. And they call that the Maddox Law. And so by that time, I had already come to the attention of the New York legislature, certainly with Howard Beach and then Marla Hanson and then a number of other cases. And then after that, Marla Hanson went down to the U.S. Senate and got them to pass some resolution condemning me. And so it just went on and on. So there was some real basis for them to take any action they had to take in their minds. Obviously, they wanted some client to come forward and testify against me, but nobody never did. And so time became of the essence at some point. And so they went ahead and took this action. So that more or less provides at least a background for the motivation of the New York legislature to take the action that they have taken. And it was interesting to me when I filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, that a U.S. magistrate who apparently had studied the case and told me that my only legal recourse was to go back to the New York legislature with hat in hand and apparently make my amends. And that was sort of interesting because the only way that our ancestors were able to get their freedom before the Emancipation Proclamation was to actually present a petition to a legislative body asking that body to upgrade their status from slave, in quotation marks, to free person. So, you know, we have that as all part of this process. And I think the important part of this is that once we have been subject to chattel slavery, we are still continuing to be subject to that chattel slavery. And in some way or another, whites do not see us as anything but personal property and feel as though they can take whatever action that is necessary to deal with us and what we are about. Now, when you look at the Stand Your Ground law, it's very curious because it really requires more than just a superficial examination to really understand all the aspects of where we are now. There was always, under the common law, the right of self-defense. And so now, as a result of that, you know, the common law arose where the word common really explains what the law is about. Because what it basically says is that in England, when you had various sections of England having a similar problem, and when all of the different provinces or states or whatever they may have been in England at the time all agreeing unanimously on a certain kind of response to that problem, then that became part of what is known as the common law. And so eventually, as a result of that, when this country in progress, work in progress, people brought the common law from England as part of how issue would be ruled upon. And so, you know, they obviously continued until the drafting of the U.S. Constitution in 1787. And at that particular time, there was a realization that, especially about what is called the Iroquois Confederacy, that's a group of state nations of Indians. They don't necessarily want to be called original American because they want to be called what they think they are. And so as a result of that, this Iroquois Confederacy was doing trading with the colonies. And when the colonies started talking about developing Articles of Confederation, which was a forerunner to the U.S. Constitution, the Iroquois Confederacy pointed out that it would be very difficult for them to do business under the Articles of Confederation because the Articles of Confederation elevated states' rights over federalism, and that that was a problem in terms of the enforcement of the law. So that's why we got to reverse from states' rights to federalism as being the core of the legal system in the United States. Now, after that, obviously, that problem was resolved. Then the next question came about was the abuses that the colonists had suffered from the English. And so then you had what is called the Bill of Rights, and these various experiences were examined and therefore antidotes to prevent those experiences from reoccurring again were put into the Bill of Rights. And one of the things that is of particular interest in it is that the First Amendment, and I was told this in law professor, told this by a law professor rather, that the First Amendment is called the First Amendment because the most basic rights, the most fundamental and important rights in the Constitution are in the First Amendment. And so obviously after that, the Second Amendment became the second most important right in the Constitution, and that is the right to bear arms. And basically, this is where the problem has come front and center, because under the slave codes, dating back to the 17th century, blacks had no right to defend themselves in any manner from abusive whites, and they had no right to kill a white person. They had no right of self-defense, to put it succinctly. And so, as a result of that, that has basically carried on, and certainly carried on, up to the time that Judge Taney, delivered his dictum, in Dred Scott, in which he said that no Negro has any rights that whites are bound to respect. And, you know, that certainly included the right of self-defense or anything else. Now, the Civil War itself was fought over this. At least we fought over this. I mean, whites may have been out to save the Union, but the thing that disturbed our revered ancestors was Taney's dictum. And so we not only went to war, but we went to war to try to reverse that. Unfortunately, that particular dictum has become the controlling legal principle in American jurisprudence, even up to this very date. And there has been no one to actually reject or would reject what Taney said back then. And I'd like to point out to the listening audience that Taney is considered by the law professors who took a poll about 30 years ago as to the 10 greatest justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. And these law professors, obviously in the middle of the Civil Rights Movement, voted for Taney I mean, Taney has been one of the great justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. So while on one hand people may want to try to dismiss him and belittle him, the reality of it is that in the legal profession, Taney is very well respected as a justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the problem that exists now is that the slave codes still have much prominence in American jurisprudence to this very day. And what I have studied is that most justices still honor the slave codes, and that and when they are to deliver jury instructions to juries, most of these instructions are based on slave codes. And I like to just point out one thing as an experience to show you just how bad it is. Now, certainly, I've always been considered as one of the top lawyers in New York. And C. Vernon Mason had also been considered as one of the top lawyers. And Al Sharpton had been considered as one of the top activists. And yet, when we were sued by Steve Pagonis in a defamation lawsuit in Dutchess County, and we went to Dutchess County for a trial that lasted for nearly a year, which was the longest civil trial in the history of New York, Justice Hickman had the audacity from the beginning on the issue of defamation to tell the jury that truth is no defense to defamation. Now, obviously, on the Hornbook Law, which is basically which is studied by most law students, I took a course on torts, and process was the Hornbook that we studied from at that particular time. It is without doubt stated that truth is an absolute defense. And yet he would tell that to a jury in the presence of two lawyers who were well-versed in the law, and would tell that to an activist as well. And the question that came up in my mind was, well, if this kind of legal system is available to us, then what is being done to the unlettered blacks and the poor blacks and the other blacks who do not have the resources that we obviously had, and what are the judges telling them in their particular cases as it relates to what the legal instructions were? Now, when he made that statement, I was versed in legal history, and so I was very much aware of the Sedition Acts of the 18th century. And basically what those acts came to mean was that you can't criticize a public official. Now, these acts apply to white people. So, during that particular time, there were several pieces of litigation over criticizing public officials, Thomas Jefferson being one of the public officials that were being criticized, and in his particular case, a newspaper publisher claimed that Thomas Jefferson had a black woman in the White House, and she was a first lady. And so, obviously, Thomas Jefferson went nuts and had him committed to prison for a long period of time as a result of that. Now, my point is that if this is available to subject to a black defendant, then what happens, to all the other blacks who have to go through the criminal justice system? And then second case, which is of interest to me, is the case of People versus John White. And John White was a black man who had a home in Suffolk County, and a white mob invaded his property, trespassed on it, and shouted racial obscenities and racial epithets, and stated they were there to kill him and rape his wife and kill his son. And eventually John White, on his property, shot one of the white thugs, and he obviously died. And later, the Suffolk County grand jury indicted John White for murder, and he had to be tried. And a jury convicted John White of defending himself, his wife, and his children from a white mob. And the judge's reason was is that he should have called the police and ran and waited until such time as the police arrived. But instead, he took the law into his own hand and killed a white man, and he should go to prison for that. And what is interesting about that is that I have also spent some time at the headquarters of the National Rifle Association, because you're talking about guns, you certainly got you can't, in my mind, you should not be oblivious to the National Rifle Association. And one of the things that they tell you, and they sell books on that, is that you should not call 911. And yet, in these jury instructions that the judge gave in John White's case, this is exactly the basis for his conviction, is the failure of him to call 911 and to take matters into his own hands. And so as a result of that, basically the point that I'm making is this, is that anytime that you see the word code attached to any legislation, the word code means that there is fear, and that a person has a right to protect themselves from fear. And this is the history of the slave codes. Every time there was slave rebellion, whites would go back to the legislature and get a harsher law enacted in order to deal with slavery and how to control blacks. Now, on the date that Michael Dunn came to that service station, he looked and saw four black boys in a vehicle, and apparently he said that the music was too loud, and he asked them to turn it down, he claims. And at some point, they seem to have may have turned it down, and then later on, the music went back up again, and he got irritated. And so after he becoming irritated, he then went into his glove compartment and pulled out his gun and went to work, and I think fired a total of 10 rounds into the vehicle. This was his way of resolving the matter. Now, the issue that comes up as a result of this is that when he was prosecuted last week and the week before on this, there were many prosecutorial miscues. I think we've talked about some up to now. I'm going to introduce another miscue today. Now, the miscue today is one that you have never heard on MSNBC. You never heard on CNN. You never heard on Sirius Radio or anybody else. But that is this, and that is Don was permitted to put character evidence into the case. And basically, he showed that he was a person of good character. Even though the prosecutor had evidence that he was a racist, and even though the admission of character evidence opened up all other avenues against a defendant who decides to use character evidence, the prosecutor refused to put evidence that he was known in the community as a racist. And that's what character evidence is. It's really gospel evidence. And basically what the community says about you. Now, may not necessarily be true, but it's still gossip evidence. And so, and this is what the community has been saying about him, and that the fact that he was a bully. Prosecutors chose not to introduce that. Now, but on the other hand, there is something else that was very much omitted from this case, and that is habit evidence. So in addition to the prosecutor not using evidence of bad character on cross-examination, the prosecution also did not introduce evidence of habit. And basically, habit would show that a person operates in a particular manner in very much the same way, and that is to suggest that something is done by habit, to suggest it's done without particular thought, but as a matter of personal routine. So with habit evidence, the concern would be, well, without even thinking about it, is this how you really handle yourself when you confront with various situations as a matter of a particular routine? And so by not presenting this habit evidence or by not questioning about it, you were actually giving Michael Dunn a pass. Now, the habit evidence will go much like this. Mr. Dunn, you're a resident of the state of Florida, is that correct? Yes. And the state of Florida is known as a haven for college students from all over the country coming to Florida to have a good time and go to the beaches to party and all of those kind of things. Is that true? Yes. And did ever come a time when you ever heard loud music being conducted by anybody? Any college students came down to Florida? Have you ever overheard any of that loud music taking place? Now, did there ever come a time when you pulled out your gun and went to work on the college students that were down in Florida making loud music? And obviously that would be no. Now, could you explain to us why is it that you decided that you're going to pull out your gun in this particular case, especially when there was a car full of black boys? And so my point is that this could have been very persuasive in showing that obviously this was a particular situation for him, and it was not one where he did something without thought, that he actually did a lot of thinking. And as a result of him doing a lot of thinking, this arose to premeditated murder, which is exactly what happened in this particular case. So the prosecution had various weapons at its disposal, which it failed to produce because it was never the intent of the prosecutor to get a conviction for first-degree murder. And then secondly, it was also the intention of the prosecutor to create such a cloudy trial record where it could be argued on appeal that the jury instructions that were given were prejudicial, and therefore this case should be subject to reversal.
Okay. Are you ended there?
I'm going to stop here.
Okay. 888-874-4888 is the number to call to ask Alton Maddox your question or to share your views. 888-874-4888. While those calls are coming in, Alton, and the first one we get, I'll stop and take it. When you reviewed this case in the context of natural rights, civil rights, are you seeing, in a sense, that the prosecutor in this case looked at that very notion as well, the natural rights that the defendant had to, quote, self-defense, if you will, against the civil rights, which are, you know, well, more right to life, that kind of thing, the federal, usually the federal grounds on which the government becomes involved, which is after you killed, then we see what civil rights have been violated.
Well, you know, and this is interesting, so the audience can be very much aware of this. The word civil rights did not come into play into American jurisprudence until 1866, really. And that was under the Civil Rights Act of 1866, in which the legislation was dealing with discrimination and purchasing land and property and things of that nature. And so until that time, white people consider everything in terms of natural rights. But now you have the newly freed enslaved Africans. And so the question becomes, what rights do we give them? And instead of saying, well, we're just going to treat them like we treat everybody else, and we'll deal with them from a natural rights point of view, we will instead have civil rights. Now, one of the things, the first rule of natural rights is self-preservation. And so, you know, and that was obviously something that nobody could give to newly freed blacks, the right of self-preservation, because this country's had a history of denying blacks the right of self-defense, and there was no propensity on the part of the ruling class to allow blacks exercise rights under the Second Amendment. So with that in mind, there was nobody who was concerned about natural rights. And so obviously when people started the discussion as to what kind of rights blacks should enjoy, the conclusion was, well, they should be civil rights. They should be man-made rights. They should be rights that we really give to blacks, but not rights that would naturally flow from being a human being. And so now we have, you know, this dichotomy in the law and this dual standard of justice in the law, because the decision was made that we blacks should not be free; they should only be emancipated. And in the course of emancipation, there should always be a superior class and an inferior class. And that's basically the tensions that blacks in the United States are being subjected to at this particular time.
All right. We have Craig from Arizona. You're on the air with Alton Maddox.
Oh, hi. Nice to listen to your program today. And I just want to say, you know, I agree. From the point that the glove box was opened and the weapon was pulled out of the glove box, from that point, when that happened, that to me indicates premeditation. And that mm-hmm. means first degree murder. That mm-hmm. was just my comment. Thank you.
Thank you, Craig. Jay from New York, you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon. My only question to you is this, Alton. What will it take in this climate that we have in regards to stand your ground for that law to be repealed? Because it seems to me that there are just too many states and too many powerful people who are in play to keep this law on the books. And it seems like our so-called black leaders have no power whatsoever to get this removed. So what strategy must we as a people come up with to get rid of this, knowing the fact that we have a lack of leadership? and I'll listen off the air.
Thank you, Jay.
I think that's an excellent question, and the answer is this, and it's found in the U.S. Constitution, and that is the 13th Amendment. You know, after listening to the discussion that I have given and recognize that's not really a complete discussion on this particular issue, but I think the point that is very glaring and very clear is that the conduct that we are looking at now is reminiscent of the conduct that our ancestors had to face 200 and 300 years ago. And so there's a carryover of this conduct despite these constitutional amendments and these legislative amendments. But the real issue that has to be initiated here is that is for the commander-in-chief of this country to initiate under Marbury versus Madison a showing that this statute is unconstitutional because it amounts to a badge of slavery, and that basically Stand Your Ground itself, you know, goes back to a time when every white person was a vigilante, and every white person demanding our respect. And when Dunn did not feel as though he had gotten that respect, he did what the slave codes would have permitted his ancestors to do, and that is to fire every round that he had in his possession, every bullet they had in possession. And that's what he did. And so you can't get away from this without not only saying that we have prevented the institution of slavery, but you must also say that we have also stopped all of the badges of slavery. And, you know, and what is interesting, Utrecht, I am probably, and this is a very sad, it looked like I went to one law school, everybody else went to somewhere else. And I only studied one thing, and everybody else studied something else. But no lawyer has ever initiated any litigation saying that we are subject to the badges of slavery. And there's a Ninth Circuit case called Cato versus United States. That's out in California, in which Cato was seeking reparations under the 14th Amendment. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal ruled that Cato was not entitled to reparations under the 14th Amendment, but he should consider the possibility of raising a claim under the 13th Amendment. And therefore, when he said that, the case just went into oblivion. I mean, nobody has raised whether we are still slaves or not, and the fact that the institution of slavery may not exist anymore does not mean we're still not in slavery. And I think the Justice Department, President Obama, has to raise this particular issue. He can't sit idly by and keep his head buried in the sand when you have something as glaring as this. Now, I'm not a constitutional scholar, and I didn't graduate from Harvard University, but I have enough intelligence to know that what we are looking at now by thinking outside the box and connecting all of the dots, that we are dealing with slavery. And that this man, Michael Dunn, felt as though he was a vigilante. And, you know, you're dealing with the issue of culture. And he heard the word coon music, or it came up in his head that this is nothing but coon music. He's not talking about thug music, he's talking about coon music. And this, and as a result of coon music, it was always permissible in Florida and everywhere else to go coon hunting. And a lot of whites had these pickup trucks, and they had this shotgun in the back of the pickup truck, and they had a tag on the front and saying, "Don't bother me, I'm coon hunting." And I mean, everybody who grew up in the South saw that, and that's the way that whites felt. And they did conduct coon hunting. I know places in Georgia, Stewart County, Georgia, for one. Before the hunting season started, they would get this black man and release him from prison, tell him to run for his life. And then they would put the bloodhounds after him with a shotgun, and they would eventually catch him and kill him. And this started the hunting season. So these are kind of rituals that are still taking place. And it is time for Mr. Obama to show that he's on the right side, and especially when it comes to these racial injustices, and that he will take action. As long as he refuses to do that, we're going to be in a lot of trouble, Utrice. You know, one thing I pointed out was I invested my life on behalf of black people to stop racially motivated murders here in New York City. And, you know, and I started with the case of Howell Beach, and then I went to the case of Bensonhurst, in which Yusuf Hawkins was murdered. And in the Yusuf Hawkins case, Joey Farmer actually got 33 years to life in that particular case. And as you know, I mean, white folks still haven't changed that necessarily the attitude toward black people, but the racially motivated murders are not now running amok in New York City. And until Mr. Obama used his federal powers to start putting these white racists and supremacists behind bars, this condition is going to continue.
Well, we've come to the end of the program today. Thank you, Alton. I want to say a word to the audience. If you believe that you have more questions, there are quite a few people still waiting to ask you questions. Let me know if you would like to have Alton back to just deal with your questions and answers, and we'll arrange that. But thanks so much, Alton, for being with us today. This is an issue, and you dealt with it forthrightly in terms of the law. But the clear indication is that on the surface, this society might be, people would like to say it's post-racial America, whatever that means. But we see in the law, and in the not only the letter of the law, but in the spirit of the law, this is very much a society that is structured and guided and ruled on the basis of race and racial attitudes and racial thinking. And here in this case, we see it manifested as a, quote, self-defense case. But when you look behind it, and especially in the context of the history of Florida itself, it talks about the attitudes that inform actions, the attitude that this defendant had as he felt completely authorized to basically satisfy his annoyance by disposing of people's lives. And he felt confident in doing that within the context of his power and authority as a white man in the society. And that is really where we are locking horns here with that particular point of view. Thanks, Alton, for being with us today.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Eutrice. I hope I've added some light to this discussion.
You certainly have. Again, we will do open forum on Friday. And see you tomorrow. Great program tomorrow on the IRP6.